It's called The Art of Levitation, a piece by Ronald Shannon Jackson from his new album Man Dance, and he'll be with us in just a minute. This afternoon on Fresh Air at 4:25, I'll speak with John Loftus, who uncovered a bizarre clandestine operation that was put into effect at the end of World War II. Several hundred Bielorussian Nazi collaborators were smuggled into the United States and given jobs in such places as Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty. The rationale was that if we gave them homes and employment, they'd give us useful intelligence information about the Soviets that would benefit America during the Cold War. Well, this plan was discovered by John Loftus when he worked in the Justice Department's Office of Special Investigations tracking Nazi war criminals. Loftus has written a new book about it. It's called The Belarus Secret. And at 4 o'clock, we'll hear about another top-secret plan related to World War II. This one is called the M Project. It was conceived by FDR, and its goal was to devise ways of resettling the thousands of war refugees and dealing with the predicted overpopulation crisis. This project was so secret that Roosevelt insisted that no written records be kept. But one volume was written from memory several years after the project's demise. This volume was recently discovered by Sandy Meredith at the Temple University Library. She learned that the M Project had considered the idea of shipping some people out to colonize other planets and others out to third world countries. More about this at 4 o'clock. Fresh Air's film critic Bill Van Wert will be with us at 3:45 to review a new film. With me now is drummer Ronald Shannon Jackson, one of the most important drummers in jazz today. He's played with some of the major figures in modern music, including Cecil Taylor and Albert Eiler, and he played and recorded with Ornette Coleman while Coleman was developing his harmelodic style. In today's Philadelphia Inquirer, rock critic Ken Tucker wrote about Jackson's music, quote, "It's controlled, catchy anarchy with melodies for pop fans to follow and rhythms for people who like to move when they listen to music." Jazz critic Francis Davis has written, quote, "Jackson promises to be a strong force for unity in the still emerging music of the 80s. He has picked up the loose threads of funk, free jazz, new wave, trance music, and Coleman's theories of harmelotics, and gathered them all together in a bright and intricate bow of rhythms and dissonance." Ronald Shannon Jackson is in Philadelphia to perform tonight at Goodhart Hall in the Bryn Mawr College campus. This concert is sponsored by the Alternative Concert Series, and for more information, you can call 896-6606. That's tonight at 8 Bryn Mawr College, Goodhart Hall. And I'll have that phone number again for you a little later. Before we speak with Ronald Shannon Jackson, let's listen to another selection from his new album, Man Dance. This is a piece called Iola. Thank you. From the new Ronald Shannon Jackson album called Man Dance, that was Iola, and Ronald Shannon Jackson is my guest. He's in Philadelphia to perform tonight at Bryn Mawr College at Goodhart Hall with a performance at 8 o'clock. Mm-hmm. Welcome, and it's nice to meet you.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
Could you describe for us the concept of your band? I don't know if that's something you could put into words.
Well, the concept of this band is basically based off of rhythms itself. You know, rhythm is the key to life. It's the thing that permeates the whole universe the same as sound. Rhythm is the thing, a heartbeat, you know, the sound of kids playing in the street, the flow of a river. Everything is rhythm, everything in life. And the concept of this music is based from rhythm. Most of the compositions that we play are extenuation of rhythms that have been worked on, are being employed to develop a certain concept, a certain idea that I've either heard, I'm trying to work out on flute or something. And being so, a lot of the material, you know, we use two bass players, Reverend Bruce Johnson on electric bass and Melvin Gibbs on electric bass. One bass is playing the funk and the gospel and the blues foundation. The other one is playing more melodical jazz phrases and a classical, and sometimes sound like a sitar, Indian sitar at times, and sometimes like a Japanese koto. So therefore, we have a conglomerate of different registers within the lower registers, and I have a guitar. The guitar player, he also doubles on a synthesizer and banjo and steel guitar, which give us the upper register, say if one was looking at a keyboard. We cover the whole spectrum, but using three different components to do that. And the concept is the rhythmic phrases being developed as opposed to purely melodic phrases. So it's like what I've come upon is like a modulating rhythm type, a fluent movement that anything else can be layered on top of, whether it's classical or hillbilly or pop or Hungarian or an African or an Irish type of melody.
You're probably one of the few modern jazz composers to use a banjo in one of your pieces. What inspired the banjo?
The piece that you're talking about, Iola, the piece we just heard was, I was just happened to be in New York, and I'm from Texas, and you know, sometime we travel. Sometime life can become so hectic, so anguish, so hellish that we escape for a moment, and I happened to go back, not to my hometown, but to my mother's hometown, which is like a little whistle stop down in Texas. And there, when I used to go there in the summer and pick cotton and watermelons and those types of things, on Saturday they had these big dances, you know, people got together and put, got these old big wash tubs and fill them with ice and beer. And the banjo players and the guitar players and trombone players and somebody with tambourine and some couple of people singing and somebody playing a bass drum, and all these elements would get together. And I used to hear this, and when I was in New York and I was really going through some heavy Sanshoshima problems at that point in my life, and that's what I heard, you know. So I wrote it down, and that's where it came out.
You've played with Ornette Coleman, and you were playing with him at the time when he developed what he calls harmelotics.
Mm-hmm.
What I'd like to do is play like a excerpt of one of those compositions that you're featured on. We'll just listen to a minute of it and then talk a little bit about what it is that you're doing there and how it differs from what had been done before. Let's listen to a selection.
Sure.
from Macho Woman, and this is one of Ornette Coleman's bands with my guest Ronald Shannon Jackson on drums. An excerpt of Macho Woman from one of Ornette Coleman's earlier records with Ronald Shannon Jackson on drums. When Coleman was first playing this and you were in the band, what kind of discussion was there about the harmony and melody and rhythm that you would be doing? How did he express it to you when it was first developed?
Well, he didn't. That came about because he and I come from the same hometown. And when he played the piece, I knew what he was, you know, I just happened to know what he was looking for. Same as, even though Jamal Adeem, who's from here in Philadelphia, you know, he was more in tune with on it in terms of harmonies because of the bass parts involved. But basically, it was I knew when I heard the melody what he was after. You know, it was like the freedom and joy we used to experience playing music before we were thrown into the environment of having to make a living from it. You know, before we realized that you know it was supposed to be done a certain way. You know, so what I had to do was to forget what I had been doing. In terms of the type of drums I was playing as a supporting background role in order to make a living and play the way I had grew up playing in Texas, just playing music, playing from what the music was, what the music called for, as opposed to providing a backdrop, yeah. A scene, yeah, that kind of a scene. In other words, playing with the music, at being totally one with the music. In other words, not... Everything was equal, was basically what we were dealing with then, at this point, you know. And I had always felt that way. I knew this, you know. But I was only able to experience very briefly, say, when I worked with, only when I'd worked with Albert Ayala, I worked with Mingus for a minute. And when I worked with Cecil Taylor, and then with my own music, I tried to go to that same space because I know that that's where human joy resides in terms of feeling and expression and the it's like a key, the opening to go out.
When you hear music like that for the first time, you know it's different from anything you've heard before. One of the things that seems to be different about it is that some of the musicians seem to be playing in different keys.
Mm-hmm,
is that what's happening?
That's what's happening, but that's not so much new as it is going to where music resides on a much more joyous basis as opposed to staying within a European context. If you stand in a European context, even with rhythms, you're going to stay on, basically you're going to play in one, you might modulate in a certain way, but it's modulating from 3-4 to 6-8 or to 4-4 or to 5-4. It's never modulating within the rhythms themselves. You know, you play a 5 and then a 3, and then it's always in a set amount of measures or bars to play this specific way. Where music itself is not like that. Music itself is like life itself. And the way we've been trained is to so that everyone can learn the same thing, whether he's living in Moscow or living in Nigeria or living in Tokyo. You could read the same music. That's fine, but that's not what music. Music actually comes itself in a number, in an infinite variety of ways. So that if one plays what one really hears as opposed to making it so that it can be played by the multitudes, then you come out with what's more or less called harmonic or pure music. So that the keys don't have to be the same key because the instrumentation is different. You know, the same way as I write for the drums from a rhythmic bass, and Arnett writes from a saxophone, and Blood Omer writes from a guitar, and Cecil writes from the piano. You know, these the different it's all different elements. So I hear the way I hear it would be different from what either one of those people I named would hear it, but it'd still be going to the same space.
I think our ears are kind of accustomed to things resolving because mm-hmm. most of the music I think most of us grew up with. Has some kind of resolution in it, which mm-hmm. doesn't really happen in a lot of your music. There's a constant conflict. There's a lot of tension in it, and that I think is where some of the energy comes from. Is there anything that you and other musicians playing this have had to unlearn?
Well, you see, what I'm trying to basically, I guess, explain is that when musicians get together and play purely for the sake of what we're doing, I'll say as we used to do in Texas. It was just the joy and sorrow and all those things, right? Now, when musicians get together in this environment up north here, it's more like from a European context, everybody knows certain songs, certain melodies. So that's like constricting. So, and the music we're playing is not constricting.
So, what?
Go ahead.
So, when you were first playing this with Ornette Coleman, did you just spontaneously play it, or was it discussed first, or?
Both. What we had to do was actually come together and shout out the world. So we had to move together. We went to Paris and lived there for about almost 8 months. And a fellow let us have a studio for this time. And we'd go out to different countries like Italy or Germany or other places and work. But we'd always use Paris as a home base. And every day we worked all day from 12 to about 10 in the evening. And this way we could work out what we knew was already there, you know. Well, we wasn't working with anything that was totally new. It's just what we knew as musicians that exist, that when people come out to socially to hear music, they don't want to hear that. They want to hear something familiar. It's easier for you to go and for music to play something that's not disturbing you while you're having a meal or you're having a cordial or something, you know. It's easier for that kind of music as opposed to pure music, which musicians normally would hear because of their constant involvement with instruments itself. But what's given to the public is a much more filtered, a watered-down version of what music is according to the way we live. Because the entities that wrote the music, Beethoven, the music Beethoven wrote, the music that any of you great composers who wrote before we got locked into certain categories, is still here. It still permeates the universe. So we hear that and play that.
You've played with two rhythm sections where there's two drummers and two bass players, two guitarists. How do you communicate? Because that, do you know what each rhythm section is going to be doing?
You see, as a person of African descent, you know, if you listen to the Chad tribe, you listen to the Pygmies, you listen to any African group play, they tell a whole story. And instead of playing the instrument, say like if I was a guitar player, instead of just playing the drums, which I very seldom try to do, I try to play music as opposed to playing the drums. Because the drums can be an ego trip and the guitar can be an ego trip. Any instrument can be a very big ego trip. But what you hear in Africa is people playing about life condition, about experiences. And if you play from the love, with the love and compassion and the understanding of listening to everyone else and playing what you hear within that context, then it's very easy to do. It's only when you're thinking you have to outdo someone or you have to play a certain within a certain confined frame in 4/4 or 3/4 or you have to there has to be someone on top of it or something like that or any type of the formal way the music is heard, then it gets confusing. Because you listen to any African tribe, they will play a piece and everyone will stop precisely on time. And the dynamics are all there. The same, though, if you listen to a Hungarian folk music, you know, you can experience the same thing. And this is not learned music, per se. This is music coming through people. People are just being mediums for what permeates the whole space of life.
It sounds like you've listened to a lot of music from different parts of the world. How have you found what you've listened to?
Well, one of my... I went to Dortmund, which has a vast musical library on a world music, and I listened. Then I went to the library, Lincoln Center. They have a library at Juilliard, and whenever I travel to Europe, in Paris, you can go to stores that specialize in African music, specialize in music from all over the European continent, and Indonesian, Turkish, music from Australia, and I'm talking about the Aborigines, music from China, all cultures. And then on an easier, accessible level, you can find on UNICEF. UNICEF has recorded all the cultural music of the world. Yeah, but there are independent ones. There are record shops that are full of them. It's just we're so programmed here by the music we hear, music that is put out to us. But when you go to different countries, it's not this way. You might hear Beethoven one moment, and then you might hear Elvis Presley the next moment. Then you might hear Chopin, and then Ray Charles, and then you might hear one of the country's folk melodies, then Duke Ellington. You know, it's all music. It's all beautiful music, but it just gives you much more a lift of where consciousness really can go to. And that's what music should really do. It should take us and free us for a moment and give us this kind of joy and this kind of warmth and love that we are as human beings are capable of, as opposed to just having to figure we have to just use it for a function.
Let's listen to another selection from Man Dance. And if you're just joining us, Ronald Channon Jackson is my guest. And he'll be performing with his group tonight at Goodhart Hall on the Bryn Mawr campus. And we're going to hear Man Dance from the album.
Hi.
Man Dance. Do you want to say anything about it before we hear?
Well, Man Dance, I wrote, is a celebration of man's accomplishment. You know, when you set out to do something, you know, and you, every day you work at it, and a month, a year, however long it takes, you complete that goal, you know, and it's such a such a relief, but not just relief, a very hideous relief, a pleasure-giving relief, you know, because you as a human being have accomplished something that you really set out to do, and it's like you're a winner at something, and you feel good about it. So, you know, it's like that dance, you know. You could equate it with, say, you know, you won the lottery for $2 million, you know, all of a sudden. That's another kind of joy, right? That's you've been wanting something all this time and working at it one way or another, right? And that kind of joy, I haven't heard expressed that much. And I know it's there at times when I receive something I've been working at and I really accomplish it, and I jump up in the air. You know, I don't have to have any music. I just dance inside as a human being, as a person living this lifetime.
Well, let's hear it. This is Man Dance, written by drummer Ronald Channon Jackson from his new album, Man Dance.
Thank you.
Ronald Shannon Jackson and the Decoding Society from their new album called Man Dance, and that was Man Dance. And he'll be playing tonight with his band at Goodhart Hall on the Bryn Mawr College campus. We've played with Orna Coleman, who we talked about, and Cecil Taylor and Albert Eiler. How did you meet up with Eiler, and did playing with him change your music?
I met Albert through a number of what at that time would have been, to me, what is called coincidences. Now it's just a life of Miojo, so I'll get to that part, right? About 2 weeks after I arrived in New York, a friend of mine who was playing drums with Ornette Coleman, his name was Charles Moffett, he had this record date, and he came by and picked me up in my drums and took me over to the studio. And he told the fellow who he was supposed to be doing a date for that he couldn't do the date because he was committed to working with Ornette, and Ornette didn't want him working with other groups at that time. And that I was fresh in New York from down in Texas, and that I was more than capable of doing a date. And the fellow's name was Charles Tyler. And it was an ESP record date. And under the given situation, we went into the studio and made one track of each song, and that was the record date. You know, it wasn't where you go and you record half a day and you go back and see if you like that and come and do another. And at the end of that session, which lasted about an hour and a half, a young man walked up to me and asked me, he told me he liked what I played. He knew I'd never met Charles Tyler before because Charles Tyler was in his group at that time. And he said his they had just come back from Europe and his drummer was no longer with the group and that he was needed a drummer and would I play with his group. And I said, sure. And that was Albert Eiler. That's how I met him. It's a continuing part of my lives, my different cycles of life. You know, it's music, just as music is part of my life. It's not, it's eternal. It's something that's been going on from ages. You know? I met Cecil. One evening I went to, I practiced Buddhism. I chant Nam Myoho Renge Kyo. And I went to a meeting, and I, Buster Williams, a friend of mine, was on his way downtown. And I knew he was riding a cab because he had his bass, and I asked for a ride. And I went to where he was playing, I left, and my mind was saying, my stomach was saying, go get something to eat. But my mind was saying, go into the Vanguard, which is a well-known jazz place in New York. So I went in the Vanguard, and I went in the kitchen, and Cecil Taylor was in the back there drinking champagne. And we started talking, and he asked me, we were talking about music, and he asked me what I do, and I told him I played drums, and he asked me, could I play? And I told him I played what I played better than anyone else on this planet. And he said, well, you know, prove it. And the next day we got together, and that's how I got that job.
You said to him I play better than anyone else on the planet?
I play what I play.
Oh, oh.
You know, okay. Because surely I'm not a technical expertise. I do not have on the drums. You know, I have never seek to be technically the most perfected drummer. Solely because those drummers who I've seen doing that were so much into playing drums, I didn't hear them playing any music. So I tried to avoid it. I tried to stay well enough lubricated in my pulsation and rhythmic expression to be technically proficient enough to do what I hear. So when I said that, I said that because I had developed my own ideas about playing. You know, I had different rhythms. I had a different approach to it that I was using that no one had been doing, and I knew this because I had been locked away for about two years, not playing with anybody and just developing these ideas.
Did Cecil Taylor, Albert Eiler, or Ornette Coleman ever make any suggestions to you in your music, or did they just have you play and that's what happened?
Well, Albert just told me to play everything that I heard, you know, which mean it's kind of difficult to really describe this because what I'm saying is like what as musicians you hear that, right? Cecil I just played what I had been working on for the last 2 years, and that's how that came out. And with Arnett, it was like playing what we had been playing in Texas. I didn't meet Arnett in Texas because he was 10, 12 years ahead of me, but playing that openness from that kind of feeling.
We've talked about some of the great musicians who you've played with. You've also spent some time playing the kinds of gigs that a lot of musicians play, weddings, bar mitzvahs, things like that. And we've talked about, you know, music from around the world. I think that weddings and bar mitzvahs have a kind of music unique unique to those occasions. What kind of music did you play at the weddings and bar mitzvahs? Was it was it your typical bar mitzvah bands?
Havagila. Right, and polkas at a... I played Irish and Hungarian weddings. In New York is such a conglomerate of ethnic groups, right? And I used to live in Queens. And in order to make a living, you know, you could play jazz, and the jazz gigs weren't paying any money. You know, they were, you pay four sets a night, and it lasts from 9 o'clock to 3 a.m, but you didn't make any money. So one wedding or bar mitzvah on a weekend would make up, you know, enough to pay the rent. You know? So it was an interesting experience because you get to see you were in the midst of another whole cultural spectrum, different, not only different music but different foods, a different variety of food, you know, and different expression of life. You know, to see different groups at their joy, as opposed to the mask that you meet on people every day in the street, you know, to see how people really, when they get together, express life, you know. So,
usually I think at those affairs, though, you find some of the most corny versions of the current tunes. Most of the wedding bands learn, like, the top 20 hits and make medleys of them. I went to a wedding or bar mitzvah where there was a Village People medley, very, very poorly played, that everybody got up and danced to. What kind of, did you get anything musically from that experience?
Sure. Cause and effect operates in everything in life. And playing those type of gigs introduced me. See, because I'm coming from basically a swing jazz orientation. So it was an opportunity to learn all those current pop songs. So that when I had the opportunity to play a cabaret job that was paying more money than I'd ever made in life, 5 days, 20 minutes an evening, I was familiar with these songs. And one of the songs I had to play every night was Havagilda, because the star of the show, that was his song. Another thing I had to play with different, it was a different act each night except for one act, which was the fella who was like a star attraction. So all those things actually just prepared my life for this particular job, which was a job I stayed on until I met Arnett. And when I met Arnett, I went on to change and being able to play what I hear as a person, as an entity, as opposed to playing for the entertainment of the evening.
Yeah. I think when people go to look for apartments, they make sure that a drummer isn't living next door. Has your music determined where you can live?
I live up on the Upper West Side in Manhattan on 87th Street, you know. But I couldn't play in any building, not the way I play. You know, it just would be, no one would be able to stay, not only above or below or next to me, but for a block. So I have a studio in a place called the Music Building. That's in Manhattan. It's a 12-story, used to be a, it's in the Gami District. It used to be where they make clothes. And they partitioned it off and made soundproof rooms, and they rent them out singly. So this is where I keep all my equipment and my rehearsed band. And it's also my place of solitude, because I can go there early in the morning and no one's there, you know. And I don't have a phone because that would bring in every mundane world, and I just try to keep that as my place to go, you know, my space to go to.
So do you have practice pads at home, or do you not bother with that anymore?
Well, I have a practice pad there, and I have a little boy, you know, and he loves to bang on everything, so I try to steer him in the correct way of holding things. I try to show him a few things, but, you know, he's not ready for it. When he gets ready, he goes and does what he wants to do. So I put the pads so he just don't beat up all the furniture and stuff. You know, so.
Well, I've really enjoyed talking with you, and I really enjoy your music, and I want to thank you for being here. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, Terry. It's a pleasure to be here, and I hope a lot of people here in Philadelphia come out and really experience this music, because the record is one thing, but the live performance is a whole new experience.
Okay, well, let's hear another record in the meantime, and we'll hear another selection from Mandance. But before I do, let me tell you again that Ronald Shannon Jackson will be performing tonight at Goodhart Hall at Bryn Mawr College. It's part of the Alternative Concert Series. And for more information, you can call 896-6606. That's 896-6606. Again, that concert at 8 o'clock tonight, Goodhart Hall on the Bryn Mawr College campus. Well, from the new Ronald Shannon Jackson and the Decoding Society album on Antilles record called Mandance, this is When Souls Speak.
Thank you.
When Souls Speak from the album Man Dance featuring drummer Ronald Channing Jackson and the Decoding Society, and they'll be performing at Bryn Mawr College tonight at 8. It's 10 minutes after 4. This is Fresh Air on WHYY FM in Philadelphia, 91 FM. And I want to remind you that in about 15 minutes, we'll be hearing about a project that was a secret project when President Roosevelt was in office. It was at about the time of World War II, and it was a project that was supposed to figure out ways to relocate war refugees and to deal with the overpopulation crisis. This was so secret that no written records were supposed to be kept from it, but one was written from memory years later. And a freelance writer from Philadelphia discovered this document, and that's what we'll be talking about. And then at 4:25, we'll be hearing about another secret scheme during World War II in which several hundred Nazi war criminals were smuggled into the United States. So that's all coming up later on Fresh Air. Well, with me now is film critic Bill Van Wert, who is going to be reviewing the film Sophie's Choice. Welcome back, Bill.
Thank you, Terry. Sophie's Choice is the best-selling novel by William Styron, and it's been adapted to the screen by Alan J. Pakula, starring Meryl Streep, Kevin Kline, and Peter McNichol in the roles of Sophie, her Jewish lover Nathan Landau, and Stingo, a young boy from the South who's come to Brooklyn to discover life and write a novel about his mother. This triangle, obviously, because of the adaptation from novel to screen, can't capture all the good detail from the book, but I think it's the best piece of American filmmaking that I've seen in the last year. Why I say that is because of the crisp, sparkling performances in terms of the acting, primarily Meryl Streep. I think Meryl Streep has gotten good press in the past for roles which, because they fit into relatively well-done films, gave her good publicity. And I'm thinking of something like The French Lieutenant's Woman, where there wasn't a whole lot to do except be mysterious or to say a couple lines at well-heightened points. Sophie's Choice really revolves around her performance in terms of her changing moods. And it's a film that's fascinating because as she unfolds her past, as she tells the truth about the past, and I can't say it on the air here without giving the film away, so it's a tricky review without telling what happens. But as she tells the truth about her past in the concentration camps, the flashbacks themselves swallow up the present. And to me, that's the mark of a fascinating film, where the more we find out about her, and it's not a chronological retelling of the past, which is also interesting. It's reminded me of some of Alain René's retellings of the past, for example, in Hiroshima Mon Amour, which is also about World War II. She becomes more and more fascinating to us, and she becomes a character who is clearly larger than life and was so in the past. And it's interesting then to come back to the present and try and guess at motivations for behavior. The one melodramatic choice from her past, I think, also makes for fascinating choices in the present in terms of who she's with, when she leaves, why she says what she does, and so forth. That fascination, I think, is rendered quite well by Streep in just a whole gamut of emotional moods, from outright fear and paranoia to very loving, kind of old world transplanted in America, an interesting eccentric character who clearly doesn't belong too much anywhere after we know about her past.